Montana Indian Country by Arnold R. Massengill. Chapter 1. While I am traveling along Highway 212 in southeastern Montana, my Ford Dually diesel truck suddenly starts acting up. I get a sinking feeling in my gut knowing I could surely be stranded out here in the middle of nowhere if my truck quits running now. I know for sure I have fuel. I fueled up in Billings earlier in the afternoon when I stopped to eat. I did this before leaving the interstate and taking the two-lane highway that cuts across the Cheyenne Indian Reservation and Custer National Forest. I'm climbing the last ridge on the east side of Custer National Forest when the engine first falters. I barely make it to a wide shoulder area before it dies altogether. I know right away from past experience that another electric fuel pump has failed. It has already been a long day of driving, and I was hoping to make it to Rapid City, South Dakota before bedding down for the night. So much for that plan. There's nothing left to do now but tackle the job out here on the side of the road while there's still a couple of daylight hours left. I carry a spare fuel pump, so getting back underway only requires me to remove the failed pump and install the new one. It's an easy enough job for someone who has been through it before. However, when it happens, and where it happens, can present its own set of challenges. In the middle of nowhere, late in the evening, is not my ideal circumstances. But I am thankful it's not 10 degrees. This time, the fuel pump's located inside the frame directly under the driver's door. I jack up the left front wheel, slide some short boards under the tire for safety, and get out the necessary tools to do the job. I spread a blanket on the ground under the truck, gather my tools along with the new pump, and slide under the truck to undertake the job. My mind wanders aimlessly while I work at my task. I think about the history of the area and the harsh environment surrounding me at this particular location. I envision living in this region during the early years of the white man's migration from the East. Those that made it this far were more than just tough. They had to have great courage and the will to survive. They were not discouraged by the Indian tribes of the region, as history will show. For better or worse, the plight of the Native American Indians is duly noted all along the road west of where I broke down. I finally finish the job just as the sun sets and darkness starts to creep up the ridge. Now, I'm already tired from a day of driving, and laying under my truck working to replace the failed fuel pump doesn't help. While I'm laying there and looking out at the fading light, I start to feel the last of my energy slip away. I close my eyes for just a moment. Before I know it, I am fast asleep. What happens next? Well, Chapter 2. June 23rd, 1876. I'm suddenly startled awake by the noise coming from the top of a nearby ridge. I instinctively roll over and reach for the Winchester rifle that's laying beside me on the blanket. The sound of hoofbeats, the whooping and hollering of Indians, it all appears so close and moving rapidly closer. I look over and see Jess is already propped up on one elbow with his rifle ready to fire. I was going to let you sleep a little longer, but it sounds like we have plenty of unwelcome company coming up the backside of that ridge over yonder, he says while pointing the barrel of his rifle through the spokes of the front wagon wheel and toward the top of the ridge to our right. I turn onto my stomach and shoulder my rifle while watching Indians appear on top of the ridge. I point my rifle at the group as it grows larger and say to him in as calm a voice as I can muster, I was not expecting to have to deal with anything like this when we stopped last night. Jess grins at me with the usual wide grin he displays when he's under such trying situations. He then says, me as well. I'm hoping they won't stop for just one wagon, but maybe they will just go on to join the other tribes at Powder River. We can only hope, I say, while turning toward the noisy band of Indians gathering on the top of the ridge. I move cautiously behind the rear wagon wheel for some protection and place the barrel of my rifle through the spokes. We lay there waiting under the wagon while holding our rifles ready to fire if necessary. It's June 2003, 1876. Jess Walker and I are running freight between Billings, Montana, Belfourche, and Rapid City, South Dakota. We normally stop in Broadus, Montana, which is another 10 miles, but nightfall caught us before we reached the town. Night before last, we stopped in Busby, Montana. We stopped to spend the night and drop off supplies to the Army's 7th Cavalry Regiment camp there. We left the campsite of General Custer and his men in Busby late yesterday morning. We left behind one empty wagon and one team of mules at the local livery stable, then doubled up for the final leg of the trip to Rapid City. We will pick up the team and wagon on our return trip. We heard news from the soldiers at Busby that most of the hostile Indians were coming south out of Sioux territory and north out of the Arapaho and Shoshone lands. They were gathering at Powder River before moving north to Little Big Horn, Since that was the case, we figured the trail to Broadus would be clear, and we could make it through with little or no trouble. Chapter 3. Our team of 6 mules are still hobbled, hidden in the trees just below where the wagon is setting alongside the trail. There's no chance of hooking up the team and making a run for town. Jess and I can only wait patiently for what could be a firefight for survival. I break the silence by saying, "Jess, you know that $10 I owe you?" "Yeah, what of it?" "I was going to pay it back to you when we reach Rapid City." "Well, Cal, with that being said, now, I got something to live for." "I just thought I would mention it," I say, while not taking my eyes off the Indians. The noise stops and we see a small band of Sioux Indians at the top of the ridge looking down at our wagon and pointing. I count as many as 20 Indians, all carrying rifles. "Jess, I counted 20 on top of the ridge." "Yeah, me too. There could be more that we can't see." The leader of the group raises his rifle over his head and shakes it up and down. Some of the Indians let out a blood-curdling scream and start to move down the ridge in our direction, but for some reason they stop and turn around. Puzzled as to why, we watch and suddenly see another larger band of Sioux Indians appear along the same ridge. The smaller band of Indians move toward the larger group. For what seems like an eternity, the leaders of the two bands face each other, talking and pointing in our direction. "Jess, among other things, I am wondering why this band of Sioux are so far east. Do you think they will attack Broadus?" "It's not likely. There are still a lot of soldiers in Broadus. That plus the local people. No, they will go on to Powder River. As for why they are this far east, I haven't a clue." "Jess, what do you think they will do now? I mean, about us. If they were going to attack, they would have come down the ridge by now," he says. "I hope you're right about that." "I am," he says, while pointing his rifle in their direction. "Look, they're leaving. Let's just stay put until they get out of sight," I say. "Cal, that's a good idea. I think I can wait until we reach Broadus for a cup of coffee." We lay there and watch as the two groups merge and walk their ponies down the east side of the ridge. The combined groups look to number close to 100 warriors. The Indians fan out into rows of 3 or more as they move onto the flat grassland leading to the Powder River. We watch until they are out of sight before we move out from under the wagon. "Why do you think the small band was making so much noise earlier?" I ask. "Probably some of the young bucks were just letting off some steam," Jess says, while walking down toward the mules. "Let's get the mules hooked up and get our butts to Broadus." "Jess, about that $10. I'll still pay you when we reach Rapid City." "Sure, you will." Chapter 4. Back in the present, the sudden sound of air brakes setting up on a big rig parking across the road wakes me out of my slumber. I look around and realize I am still under my truck. It is dark now and getting cold. I slide out, pulling the blanket holding the tools along with me. I get up and open the door looking for a flashlight. I glance at the clock and see it is going on 9 o'clock. It's evident I slept for nearly an hour while laying under the truck. I gather my tools and put them away before removing the stack of boards from under the left front tire and letting the jack down. With everything stowed away, I get in and start the engine. It fires up, and the welcome familiar sound of the 7.3 diesel tells me everything is okay. I turn on the headlights, put it in gear, and pull out onto the road heading east. I drive along thinking about the dream I had while asleep under my truck and wondering how I got transported back in time. As I travel the few miles left before leaving the National Forest, I can't seem to shake the feeling that I'm being watched and that I've been here before, back when the road was still just a trail. I am also thinking, while I drive along after leaving Custer National Forest behind, I need to get my butt to Broadus.